fission, which has a nuclear sort of weapon arsenal, they're not spared. So, of course, Iran is not going to be spared. And, of course, Iran and Russia also stand ideologically against many things that the West wants to export for the control and destruction right. of the world in general. Everything from transgender, neoliberal rights around homosexuality and all sorts of things which are culturally and okay. religiously opposed. So, you know, it's got a remit to try and bring these nations to heel.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Professor at University of Tehran, Fouad Izzetti, joining us from the Iranian capital, and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas speaking to us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now, we enlighten you with verses 40 to 43 of chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يا بني إسرائيل اذكروا نعمتي التي أنعمت عليكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وإياي فارهبون وآمنوا بما أنزلت مصدقا لما معكم ولا تكونوا أول كافر به ولا تشتروا بآياتي ثمنا قليلا وإياي فاتقون ولا تلبسوا الحق بالباطل وتكتموا الحق وأنتم تعلمون. وأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واركعوا مع الراكعين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. O children of Israel, call to mind my favor which I bestowed on you, and be faithful to your covenant with me. I will fulfill my covenant with you, and of me, me alone, should you be afraid. And believe in what I have revealed, verifying that which is with you, and be not the first to deny it, neither take a mean price in exchange for my communications, and me, me alone should you fear. And do not mix up the truth with the falsehood, nor hide the truth while you know it. And keep up prayer, and pay the poor rate, and bow down with those who bow down. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's air defenses warn of manned and unmanned foreign aircraft flying near an area of large-scale military drills in the Persian Gulf. The Russian president says the West lied about peace and was preparing for aggression, provoking Russia to launch its military operation in Ukraine. And North Korea's leader orders the production of nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missiles, accusing the U.S. and the South of plotting to isolate and stifle Pyongyang. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the Iranian Army's air defense units have warned off several foreign spy aircraft flying near an area of ongoing exercises in the Persian Gulf. That's according to a statement by the media headquarters of the drills. Now the development came after a number of manned and unmanned foreign aircraft tried to approach the area of drills to collect intelligence. In response, the Iranian Army units launched a counter drone after issuing radio warnings force the intruding aircraft to leave. According to the statement, Iranian air defense radars detected the aircraft at an altitude of 23,000 feet. Qarar drone is a turbojet-powered unmanned combat aircraft capable of delivering payloads comparable to manned aircraft. The Iranian army is staging large-scale drills in the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Drills are aimed at testing domestically built military equipment and enhancing the country's preparedness against potential threats.
It's the second day of massive naval maneuvers conducted by the Iranian army. Codenamed Zulfaghar, the drill covers over a 3 million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz all the way to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
Self-reliance, power, and sustainable security is the slogan of this drill. Here we seek to enhance our military might using our own homegrown armaments. The ultimate objective is to achieve lasting peace and security of our country and our region.
During the second phase of the military exercise, domestically made combat drones, such as Arash and Bavar, flew from the Sahand destroyer to hit mock enemy targets using the homegrown Ghaem smart bombs made by Iran's armed forces. Ghaem is a guided bomb with a pinpoint accuracy of less than half a meter.
Equipped with an infrared seeker, the precision-guided bomb can engage with fixed and moving targets, both at night and during the day.
Armed bombs, precision-guided missiles, and combat drones are used and will be used in the upcoming phases of the drill. What's important is that all these cutting-edge military equipment are designed and developed by our experts. So the message is that we are now capable of producing a wide array of hardware needed to protect our country.
Iran's military sector has been one of the industries that's been subject to decades-long sanctions imposed by the West. The army says this has prompted Iran to keep its defense industry afloat by drawing on local expertise. Military officials say today Iran produces over 80% of its needed equipment on its own.
Military officials here say this drill helps Iran's naval forces to upgrade their preparedness for real-time operations. The ultimate goal, they say, is to ensure peace and stability in regional waters, which they say are constantly exposed to extraterritorial threats. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized forum on the role of late Commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in combating terrorism. During the meeting, dubbed the Specialized Forum on Fighting Terrorism and Extremism in the West Asia region, guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies discussed the fight against terror from different perspectives. Matthew Abbasian reports.
The Center for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized roundtable focusing on the fight against terrorism and extremism in the West Asia region. Guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies took part in the forum, which concentrated on efforts made by the Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Among the most significant topics discussed during the meeting were fighting terrorism in the West Asia region from the point of view of international law, the role of General Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the West Asia region, and the role of the United Nations in fight on terror in the West Asia region. On the sidelines of the meeting, Iran's former ambassador to Iraq, Iraj Masjidi, highlighted the late commander's role in neutralizing terrorist groups in neighboring countries.
When Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, I was working as the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Iraq. He would frequently travel to Iraq in order to confront the ISIS terrorist group and help the Iraqi armed forces and Hashd al-Sha'bi with planning and logistic support. In other words, he played a prominent role in Iraq in the fight against terrorists.
Masjidi also said that efforts to bring a prosecution against those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani continues. In this regard, the head of a special Iranian committee tasked with pursuing the case of General Soleimani's assassination in domestic and international courts said an indictment on the assassination will be announced soon.
The UN report that described the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani as unlawful and arbitrary has made persecution of this crime easier for us. It clearly holds the U.S. accountable for committing this crime and violating international law. The Foreign Ministry and the Ministry of Justice have also made efforts based on the 1973 Convention, and the results will be announced soon.
He was referring to a report by a UN expert on extrajudicial killings concluding that the targeting of General Soleimani and those accompanying him constitute an arbitrary killing for which the U.S. is responsible.
Iran has had a significant role in the fight against terrorism in the West Asia region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. And Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, played a pivotal role in combating terrorism and defeating Daesh. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says that the West lied about peace and was preparing for aggression, provoking Russia to launch its military operation in Ukraine. He made the remarks in a New Year address aimed at rallying Russian people behind troops in their 10-month-long war against Ukraine.
For years, the Western allies have hypocritically assured us of all their peaceful intentions, including the resolution of the difficult conflict in Donbas. In reality, they were fully encouraging neo-Nazis, who continued to carry out military and blatantly terrorist actions against peaceful citizens of the Donbas People's Republics. The West lied about peace and was preparing for aggression. And today, they are not ashamed to admit it openly. And they cynically use Ukraine and its people to weaken and divide Russia. We have never allowed anyone to do that, and we will not allow anyone to do that.
Now, Vladimir Putin also described the war as a near existential fight for the future of Russia. He said 2022 was a year of difficult and necessary decisions. The Russian president pledged victory over Ukraine's, quote, neo-Nazis, accusing the West of being bent on destroying Russia. Putin rejected Ukraine's calls for Russian troops to leave as a precursor to peace negotiations. He added that Russian troops are defending the people of Russia and its historical territory. Putin also slammed the opponents of the war at home, saying that it has separated courage from cowardice. The Ukrainian president also issued a New Year message. Vladimir Zelensky said that 2023 will be about one thing, which is victory.
We fight and will continue to fight. For the sake of the main word, victory, it will be for sure. We have been approaching it for 311 days. We gave it a lot of strength. But at the moment, when it seems that you can't go any further, remember that we have already passed with you.
Vladimir Zelensky said Ukraine was ready to fight for freedom. He vowed to take back what's been stolen from Ukraine. Zelensky reiterated that he will stay with his people while they are fighting. Now, Russia launched a military campaign in Ukraine on February 24th, calling it a special operation. In September, four Ukrainian regions that were under Russian control held referenda and voted to join Russia. Ukraine rejected the polls as a sham. Now, during a video meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Russian President Vladimir Putin hailed strategic cooperation between the two states as a stabilizing force against what he called unprecedented Western influence.
In his opening remarks, after exchanging niceties, the Kremlin chief invited Xi Jinping to Moscow for the coming spring. He talked about the current relationship between Russia and China and called bilateral relations the best in history. He also said that he expected trade between the two countries to grow despite unfavorable global market conditions. Another very important focal point of the talks was that Russia is seeking to strengthen its military ties with China.
In the current situation of tense international and regional relations, the significance of Russia-China comprehensive strategic partnership of coordination for a new era has been further enhanced as an important stabilizer on the international stage.
President Xi's opening remarks were rather similar in tone. He also expressed China's willingness to increase political cooperation with Russia and even be global partners against the background of a difficult international situation.
Your Excellency President Putin, my old friend, it's a great pleasure to meet you once again. It has become a good tradition for us to hold a video meeting at the end of the year. Under joint guidance, the China-Russia Comprehensive Strategic Partnership of Coordination for a New Era has become more mature and resilient.
While Western nations are waiting eagerly for a softening of tone from China towards Russia as they continue to attempt to isolate Russia in the global sphere, they may have to wait a while longer. 3 weeks before the Ukraine war, Putin met with Xi Jinping in Beijing. During that meeting, a 5,000-word joint statement was released in which the two leaders declared a friendship with no limits between the two countries. In the joint statement, they also expressed their grievances towards the U.S. and its allies. They also hinted at the transformation of the power dynamics of the world and the formation of a new world order. Mainstream Western media outlets have been monitoring China's attitude towards Russia eagerly and waiting for it to take a turn. Here are a few sentences from a couple of CNN articles on this issue. Experts say China's domestic situation has also changed significantly in the months since, which could necessitate a different approach to Putin this time around. More than 10 months into the grinding war, the world looks much different and the dynamic between both partners has shifted accordingly, experts say. Experts say Russia's war on Ukraine has served to strengthen Western resolve. CNN already even hypothesized a Russia without a strong Putin and how that hypothetical version of Russia could maybe, possibly warm up to the West instead of China. Of course, these are all predicated on their assumption that Russia is already losing the war. But is the West as united against Russia as its media outlets want it to seem? Or does it prefer to make it seem that way in the face of the enemy, even if the backing for sanctions and aids to Ukraine are gained through pressure and blackmail?
Now, nearly 10 months into the Ukraine war, Western mainstream media is more focused on forcing desired outcome rather than a report on what's been happening and how the war has affected them. So let's take a look at some of the ways the media has attempted to do just that.
The media onslaught pushing a particular anti-Russian narrative was meant to make it easier to justify the billions and billions of dollars poured into Ukraine in the eyes of the public. It was also used to force smaller European countries who couldn't afford to join the collective alliance against Russia into conforming, imposing sanctions, and agreeing on the oil price cap. This also included forcing much less powerful countries with way lower GDPs than, say, France, to pay nearly the same amounts in aid to Ukraine. It is clear that some of these countries, or most, cannot afford these aids, but their overlords in NATO and the EU are the ones that make decisions for them. One of the latest stunts in the media machine to justify the massive aids to Ukraine, especially in the eyes of Americans, is featuring Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on the cover of Time magazine. The Time magazine feature is particularly ironic, and it's not like it's the first time Time has been used as a publicity stunt. That is, disregarding the more questionable choices for persons of the year. Even more recently, Zelensky's appearance in the U.S. Congress was also viewed as a publicity stunt by a certain U.S. senator. "I didn't go to the speech because I didn't want to be part of a photo op asking for more money from the United States government when they have not given us a single piece of accounting on anything they spent." And as mentioned previously, they have now set their aims on China, looking for anything they can find in the Chinese leader's tone to see if they can portray Russia as even more isolated than they have been portraying it. And so far, they have no material to work with. In this relentless media campaign that follows a very specific agenda, no other voice is allowed.
The North Korean leader has ordered the development of new nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missiles and mass production of tactical nuclear weapons. Kim Jong-un made the remark while addressing a meeting of the ruling Workers' Party. He said the move was aimed at countering threats from the U.S. and the South and to defend the country's sovereignty and security. Kim accused Washington and Seoul of carrying out a plot to isolate and stifle Pyongyang, which is unparalleled in human history. His remarks came hours after the North fired a short-range ballistic missile off of its eastern coast. Pyongyang says its new missiles are capable of carrying nuclear weapons with all of South Korea within their range. A new missile launch followed an unprecedented number of similar tests by the North in 2022. Pyongyang says the tests are in response to the U.S.'s growing presence in the region and its joint military drills with the South in Japan. Pyongyang considers such exercises as a provocation and rehearsal for an invasion. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
School of Soleimani. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are on the anniversary of martyrdom of the great anti-terror general and commander of hearts, Qasem Soleimani. As for the third part of this five-part series, you will be listening to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's role in the war against the U.S.-generated terrorists known as Daesh or ISIS. Stay tuned, please. Quds Force is one of the branches of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, whose duty goes beyond the geographical borders of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In other words, wherever the Islamic Revolution is threatened by the global arrogance and Zionist regime and their lackeys, the IRGC Quds Force will enter the scene to fight invaders and ill-wishers. Quds Force has been founded on the basis of Imam Khomeini's thought, as he said, "Today the East and the West know it well that Islam is the only force which can expel them from the scene. The officials should know that. Our revolution is not limited to Iran. The Iranian people's revolution is the starting point of the great revolution of the Islamic world under the flag of Imam Mahdi. May God have favor on all Muslims and the world people to ordain his reappearance and coming in the present age." According to Imam Khomeini, defending Islam and fighting the big powers requires mobilization of the forces of Islam all over the world. The idea of formation of Defenders of Shrine was based on this very thought of Imam Khomeini. Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani set up the Defenders of Shrine to confront and annihilate the criminal Daesh outfit. His planning and method against these beasts of the current era was based on his precious experiences of the eight-year war against the U.S.-sponsored Iraqi regime of Saddam in 1980s. He considered those experiences as an appropriate pattern to defend oppressed nations against oppressors and greedy powers. He would say, "When a nation is under oppression and an unequal assault has been made against it, if it wants to defend its dignity and nobility in a victorious way, the method of victory that was experienced is the method of the holy defense." The fruit of Martyr Soleimani's management and prudence was the formation of the Resistance Front. This front has been shaped up of different combat groups like the Hezbollah of Lebanon, Hashd al-Sha'bi of Iraq, Fatemiyun of Afghanistan, Zainabiyun of Pakistan, Haydariyun of Iraq, Ansarullah of Yemen, and so on. Various forces from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Pakistan were mobilized to defend the holy shrine of Lady Zainab in Syria and the holy shrines of the infallible imams in Iraq against Daesh terrorists. Daesh terrorist grouplet was shaped by the U.S. with the help of the fabricated Israeli regime and some of the Arab reactionary regimes, particularly the Saudi regime, to fight Islam under the guise of Islam. These generators and exporters of terrorism were plunged in the dream of the imminent fall of Syria and capturing of Syria and Iraq by their trained dog. But General Soleimani believed that the big U.S.-Israeli-Saudi plot for disintegration of the region would fail with the help of God. Thus, 4 years later, the political and media centers in the West and the Arab world admitted the defeat of their mercenary elements in the region against the resistance front. The courage and valor of the Commander of Hearts, General Qasem Soleimani, was famous all over the world. In the heat of the battle against Daesh, this sentence could be read on the website attributed to Martyr Soleimani: "Mr. Abu Bakr Baghdadi, the day when you were saying in the Friday prayer that we will take Qasem Soleimani to and will put him in the cage and burn him like the Jordanian pilot, I was sitting in the third row just in front of you." In a short time, Daesh terrorist outfit spread its unholy dominance over 70% of Syria and reached near the Iraqi capital of Baghdad. Yet, The unmatched general, Qasem Soleimani, expanded the domain of defense with the help of resistance forces. Now the nightmare of terrorists rushed to assist the Iraqi besieged Iraqi people. He said on the reason of his presence in Iraq, "When we entered for defending of the Iraqi people, we never separated the Iranian interest from the Iraqi ones. We considered the interest of the Iraqi people as our own interest, saying that if they are victorious, freed, and achieve sovereignty, these are the same as our interest. This is the outward and inward of our assistance to Iraq and Syria, and we were never in pursuit of shares and interests." According to the commander of Al-Badr Corps of Iraq, Hadi al-Amiri, Daesh was horrified even by the name of General Soleimani. He said in an interview during the life of this great martyr, "If you browse the Daesh media, you will understand how much the Takfiris are scared of this heroic combatant." Masoud Barzani, former head of the Iraqi Kurdistan, writes in his memoirs on the days when Daesh terrorists had approached Erbil and how he had contacted the embassies of the US, Turkey, Britain, France, and even Saudi regime, but none of them had agreed to help him. He writes, "The only person who came to our help was Haj Qasem Soleimani. He came with 50% of his special forces. He quickly went to the region of clashes. He mobilized Peshmerga forces and everything changed within a few hours. Later on, we captured the Daesh commander and asked him about the reason for retreating from Erbil. He answered, 'Our spies informed us that Qasem Soleimani is in Erbil. So the forces were demoralized and we retreated.'" Qasem Soleimani never forgot the oppressed people of Palestine. He caused the Palestinian resistance to enter a new phase of combat. He empowered Gaza as he considered no difference between them and other forces of the resistance front. He would help everyone to fight the fake Zionist regime. The name of Quds played a pivotal role in his life. During the 8-year Holy Defense, Tariq al-Quds, or the Way to Quds operation, was the first operation in which he commanded two battalions. After the 8-year war, he was appointed as the commander of the IRGC Quds base in the east of Iran to confront miscreants and smugglers. And in the year 1999, he was appointed as the commander of the Quds force. And his blood will be avenged by the liberation of Quds, inshallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another episode of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. It's the Christmas period, and across the Christian world, citizens are celebrating the occasion with Christmas trees and gift giving. Christians, of course, will be commemorating the occasion as the birth of Jesus Christ. However, Jesus and his mother Mary are also beloved figures in the Islamic faith too. So let's take a look at how these beloved historical figures are viewed in the eyes of Islam, starting with Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam.
Christmas is well known as the time which Christians commemorate the birth of Jesus and is a major religious celebration across the world. But what many people don't realize is that Jesus is an important figure in Islam as well, even though Muslims don't celebrate Christmas as a religious holiday. Jesus, Mary, and the angel Gabriel are all prominent characters in the Quran, as are other biblical prophets, including Adam, Noah, Abraham, and Moses. Muslims believe that Jesus, or Isa in Arabic, was a prophet of God, but not God himself. Muslims also believe he was born to a virgin mother and he will return to earth before the day of judgment to restore justice and defeat the Dajjal, also known as the Antichrist. Just as they do with all prophets, including the Prophet Muhammad, devout Muslims give salutations of peace, including to Prophet Jesus. Muslims also believe that Jesus performed miracles, including giving sight to the blind, healing lepers, and breathing life into clay birds. The story of Jesus' birth, as told in the Quran, is also the story of his first miracle, when he spoke as an infant in the cradle and declared himself to be a prophet of God. The Quran also makes clear, Prophet Jesus didn't die on the cross, as Christians believe, and instead was protected by Allah.
And for boasting, we killed the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of Allah. But they neither killed nor crucified him. It was only made to appear so. Even those who argue for his crucifixion are in doubt. They have no knowledge whatsoever, only making assumptions. They certainly did not kill him. Rather, Allah raised him up to himself, and Allah is almighty, all wise. Every one of the people of the book will definitely believe in him before his death. And on the day of judgment, Jesus will be a witness against them.
Joining us in the studio today to talk about the personalities of Jesus and Mary, or Prophet Isa and Sayyidina Miriam in Islam, we have two prestigious guests. Father Frank Gelly is an Anglican priest who is the author of a number of books. He has a particular interest in interfaith work and the religion of Islam. And Dr. Rebecca Masterton is a convert from Christianity to Islam and director of the Center of Shia and Cultural Studies. She also has authored the book Shi'i Spirituality for the 21st Century. Welcome to the show, both of you. Father, I'm going to come straight to you on this because I wanted to ask you about the fact that, you know, the prophet Isa is well respected and well beloved in the Islamic faith as well as Christianity. And these are two religions which at times historically have been rivals, if you like. But what's your view and understanding of how Jesus is viewed in Islam?
Well, I like to stress the commonalities, or we have in common. Namely, we have the figure of Isa, Jesus, and the Quran, and the Muslim tradition, is a highly respected and admired figure. And in that sense, there is a correspondence with Christianity. Some people like to stress a polemical aspect different, but that's not my interest, because God has given me a ministry of friendship to Muslims, so I don't engage in disputation, acrimonious dispute. So Jesus is actually a great treasure which we have in common, but also not only from a scriptural, if you like, historical point of view, but right here today. I mean, Jesus was a fighter for justice. He was a radical figure. I always think of Jesus as a radical. and a sort of inspiration for us, certainly for Christians today, who liberation theology and so on, who saw Jesus as a champion of freedom and liberation. So in that sense, that's how I look at Jesus. It seems to me that we have so much more in common. Of course, in Islam, Jesus prepares the way for the last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. That's a slightly more polemical difference, but I mean, that's not a problem for me.
Now, Dr. Masterton, obviously, you know, the Christian view on Jesus is quite different in some key aspects compared to the Muslim faith. He's beloved by both, but Muslims see him as not the Son of God, not God himself. That's very important. Now, how did you find, when learning about the Islamic faith, the difference, and which did you find to be sort of more appealing in that sense?
I was raised in a, I would say, nominally Christian household. So went to a church, primary school, but was never really clearly taught Christian doctrine. So I actually didn't really understand the implications of the Trinity or what even the Trinity was. So when I came into Islam, ironically, that's when I started to discover more about the person of Jesus, peace be upon him. And I went back to the Bible because I had never read the Bible growing up, and went back to the Bible and started to discover about what Jesus was talking about in terms of embarking on a spiritual path. That's how I saw it. And so actually, ironically, it wasn't until after I came into Islam that I started to uncover this message from Jesus, peace be upon him, that there is a kind of there's a hidden spiritual path underneath this kind of material way of life that we can be deluded by. So I didn't have really any kind of battle between previous and after converting. It was all quite a smooth transition, really. Yeah.
That is interesting, because Father, I'll come to you on this. With me personally, obviously, you know, there's a kind of divine angle to Jesus from a Christian perspective, and that's something which I was raised on, and there's a great emphasis on that fact, or that point, at least from a Christian perspective. How could you justify that from a Christian perspective? Because obviously Islam's position is that he is a man, after all, and that there is no God but the one God, for example. So how can this be defended, potentially, from a Christian angle?
Well, I don't have to justify it. That's just what we Christians believe. That's our faith, that is our tradition, that's the way we interpret scriptures. But I would like to say that for me...
Not all Christians believe that, though, Father. I know there are some Christian sects that are more similar to the Islamic position on
Unitarians, they're small and insignificant. They're really sort of succumbed to secular, to the spirit of the age. They're dying out, they're not significant. But yes, there was... there were several diatribes, but I want to go back to a question. For me, it is the alliance between our faiths, and especially from the eschatological point of view, with, you know, Al-Akhirah, and when we have in the Islamic tradition Imam al-Mahdi, who comes to fight Dajjal, and Jesus comes. Now, in the New Testament, in the letter the second letter to the Thessalonians, Jesus is described as slaying a Dajjal-like figure with the breath of his mouth. To me, I say that passage to signify this alliance, which is a key thing, not having a fight over theology or nothing. I've written a book about it, actually, Dajjal, the accursed Antichrist. So that is the way I look at it. We could have a big debate about how we justify or explain certain passages, but you know, what worries me, our enemies, our common enemies, want us to have a quarrel, to quarrel between ourselves. We don't have a quarrel because we've got common enemies, the ones we want to fight and oppose.
That is a very good point, very valid point. But I do want to address the issue slightly on the program, Doctor. The fact is that, you know, Jesus is a man. And I think that one of the things that made sense to me is that you know, we believe that there is one true God, mm-hmm. but that perhaps the Islamic viewpoint that other religions have gone at a slightly different path and have moved away from that initial message. Yeah. I think that's what attracted me personally to Islam the most. Would you agree with that assumption? Do you think that there is an argument to make that Islam's kind of taking other religions back towards a kind of true initial one understanding of the one true God, and that some Christian beliefs may have deviated a little bit in that sense?
That's the Islamic view, yes. And we know that in some ways Christian doctrines were discussed and hashed out. That's not really the right way of putting it, but they were kind of discussed and established. The thing is that also I know that nowadays people argue for the separation of religion from politics. I think that's even today is very difficult, and I think that probably what brought about the Christian doctrine of Jesus being the incarnation of God may also have been linked to the politics of the day, you know, the kind of the Roman Empire establishing its influence over its territories. And so when a government adopts certain doctrine, then of course those who have different doctrines become a direct threat to that government. And that may be why they are suppressed. So there were, as you say, many different doctrines. As I understand it, in Arabia, at the time when the Quran was revealed, there were many different Christian groups with at least about three different kinds of doctrines or versions of the Trinity. So it might have been set in stone, by about the 4th, 5th century among some people, but further afield, outside of the Christian center of power, there were still other kinds of variations of Christian groups. And I think that this is what the Quran addresses, because the Quran obviously addresses Christians, and it says, don't say that, the God is one of three, or that, you know, Jesus is the third of three. Stop saying this, it's not correct. And so we need to look into the history of how this doctrine developed. And I've even from an objective viewpoint, I look at the Quran objectively sometimes. I think it's very, very interesting, the whole kind of theological argument that it's making. It can sound a bit simplistic that, Islam argues that God is God, and he didn't give birth to a son. He's far above that. You know, he's transcendent above having a son. It sounds very simple. But when you actually reflect upon the subtleties of the Quran, of how it's arguing against the Trinity, and you reflect upon this as a movement that was started, you know, through the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sure, peace be upon him, then it's a very interesting kind of correction, yeah, you could say.
Well, we are going to be discussing more of this, and we're also going to discuss a little bit about the mother of Prophet Isa as well later in the show. So let's move on and have a look at the legacy of this prestigious woman in Islamic history as well as Christian history, with a look at the legacy of Prophet Isa's mother, Sayyidina Miriam, in this next report.
Mary, or Sayyidina Miriam in Arabic, is a central figure of Christianity, the wife of Joseph and the mother of Jesus. She's honored with titles including the Virgin Mother or Queen. However, she's also one of the most honored figures in Islamic theology too, with Muslims viewing her as one of the most righteous women to have lived, as per the Quranic verse.
Then came the time when the angel said, O Mary, behold, Allah has chosen you and made you pure and exalted you above all the women in the world. O Mary, remain devout to your Lord and prostrate yourself in worship and bow with those who bow before him.
Miriam features often and throughout the Quran, with her narrative occurring consistently from the earliest chapters revealed in Mecca to the later verses revealed in Medina. In fact, Miriam is referenced more often in the Quran than the Bible, with an entire chapter of the Quran also dedicated to her name. And similar to Christians, Muslims acknowledge her virgin birth to Prophet Jesus. Unlike Christianity, Sidon and Miriam is not depicted anywhere in statues or paintings, as this is considered disrespectful and blasphemous in Islamic tradition. But she remains a deeply beloved character to all Muslims, with her legacy forever cemented in the Holy Quran and Hadiths. With one saying mentioning the Prophet Muhammad, referring to Maryam as one of the four spiritually perfected women of the world.
Well, there you have it. Father, let me come back to you on this, because again, Mary or Miriam is a very important figure in both Christian and Islamic teachings. Now, perhaps you could just tell me what you make of the Muslim view of Sayyidina Miriam. Is it something which you find quite pleasing to see, the fact that there is so much respect for her?
Yes, I do, because there are more verses concerning Mary in the Quran than there are actually in the New Testament.
That's true.
In terms of number, quantity.
She might even be the only woman mentioned directly in the Quran as well, by name.
I don't know, because you are the expert here.
I looked at Dr. Marston, she agrees with me, so I'll assume that's true.
But, as you mentioned this, I must make a comment about something Dr. Marston said earlier on about these various sects which are in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, in the Arabia of the Prophet. There was, you have to be careful here with this group, there was a group called the Ebionites, who were initially Jews, who accepted Jesus, but not as Son of God, only as a Messiah. And there is some scholarship that the Ebionites actually lived on in the Middle East and eventually ended up in Arabia. And according to this view, which obviously Muslims would not agree with, they actually influenced the text of the Quran. Now, but I'm only mentioning this not to agree with it, but to say that there are various ways of looking at this sex and so on. Well, that's coming back to Mary. I pray, one of my regular prayers is Hail Mary. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. So she's part of my spirituality. And I've been to many Maria shrines and everything else. I love a passage in the Quran where she's seeking shelter somewhere in a desert place and under a palm, which gives a shade as well as dates and everything else. It's wonderful because that's a story which also exists in the Christian tradition. Now, when King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia visited Pope Benedict years ago, he brought him a palm and had explained how that, and the Pope said, "Ah, è una bella storia." In Italian, means it's a fine story. So the point is that all this, you know, there's elements linked to faith in it, the things we can want to stress together. And it seems to me there is no contradiction. I know, yes, Mary, you know, but she's giving birth to this child via the Ruh, the Spirit of God. To me, it depends on a different way. To me, that coheres with the Christian account.
Well, Doctor, one thing that I think Islam is basically, one of the issues that Islam faces these days is that it's seen as a religion which is not holding women in high regard, essentially. But actually, when we look at how the Quran emphasizes the importance of female historical characters like the mother of Prophet Jesus, we find that that's not actually the case. Perhaps you could emphasize that point. She's not the only woman in Islam that has this high status as well.
She's honored in the Quran as, you know, being of a prophetic lineage. And there is a very sympathetic story about her in the Quran. There is a kind of, she's depicted with mercy and, you know, the hard time that she went through conceiving Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, and how she faced the people of her community when they were absolutely scandalized and shocked about this conception. So, and the way she's discussed is, I mean, because the Quran does have a very consistent tone, this is something that I discovered when I was coming into Islam. How the Quran talks about all of these narratives is with this consistent tone. And so in the same way that it talks about prophets is how it talks about Lady Maryam as well. So, and then of course she's visited by this spirit from God in the form of a man, and who is going to announce to her that she is going to conceive of Prophet Jesus. So this shows that there is a respect for her and a natural acceptance of her being from a family of honor and being an honorable woman. Yeah. So, and of course, she's given a lot of prominence in the Quran as well.
Now, Father, I'm going to challenge you again on another point, because one area where Muslims would have issue is idols and the concept of setting up statues which could potentially be worshipped in a way. And I think that in some Christian practice, that seems to be the case. I think we can take, for example, what happens during services in Rome, for example. What's your view on that? How could that be justified?
Yes, some Christians, especially Protestant Christians, have disagreed with setting up images and statues. There's a difference, an image in the flat and statues in the round. But of course, I mean, I don't particularly worship statues. I mean, I don't use statues, but if I had to look at it, I would say these are just foci of spirituality, which are aids to relating to the divine. So when I think of a statue of St. Francis, who's my patron saint, in a church, I'm a Protestant, really. I'm supposed not to agree on that kind of stuff. But in the Church of England, we got a halfway house. I'm not saying, what a wonderful statue here. This is God. This is just an aid to concentrating on what Francis stood for, which was love of the poor, spirituality, miracles, and everything else. So I don't see that as a big problem at all.
Do you think that the Islamic view on this is understandable in the sense that we respect these characters so much that we don't want them to be portrayed in any way, shape, or form, because, you know, a statue can over time become sort of ugly looking. It also might encourage people to move away from the worship of the one God towards kind of like a worship of a statue. What's your view on it from a Muslim perspective? Can you understand it? Do you think that it's...
Yes, of course, I do understand it and respect, even to some extent admire the Muslims' idea of complete purity, of God, monotheism, and everything else. But, you know, that polemics in Islam itself. I mean, for example, the tradition, you cannot represent a figure of a prophet. Now, as you know, there are Mughal miniatures as well as Persian miniature, the prophet is shown as even his face is shown. It's a diversity of views.
We don't appear to have much time left of the program, so I want to ask you straight up, Father Frank. You've written about Islam. You seem to love Islam very, very much. You've learned about the religion so much over the years. Why don't you accept Islam, become a Muslim?
Oh, it's a wonderful question, isn't it? I've got a common friend, a Russian, who asked me the same question. Well, the simple answer is I'm a Christian. I like Islam, and to some extent I even admire it, but I'm a Christian. Sometimes if I want to be really wicked, it's a terrible joke, I say, well, let's say if you know Saudi prince, a very billionaire, we can discuss it in terms of £100 million. No, sorry, that's just a joke. It's not meant to be serious. But as I say, I'm a Christian, and I find in a way that I can help, if I can use the term, our common cause, Islam, more as a Christian, because I'm indicating a way which we have a common battle. If I became a Muslim, I would be just one bloke among many, wouldn't I?
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But thank you to all of our guests and to you at home as well. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, Assalamu Alaikum.
In the limelight. In the United States, Katie McEnany, a former White House press secretary, has been described as a liar and an opportunist by a former aide to Donald Trump. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Kylie McEnany, Donald Trump's final White House press secretary, is a liar and an opportunist, according to testimony to the House January 6 committee by Alyssa Farah Griffin, formerly a communications director to Donald Trump. In testimony released on Thursday, 29th of December, Alyssa Farah Griffin was asked where McEnany fell after the 2020 election, either, "Hey, we lost, let's gracefully exit," versus, "Let's facilitate the big lie that Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden was caused by electoral fraud." "I'm a Christian woman," Alyssa Farah Griffin said, "so I will say this. Kylie McEnany is a liar and an opportunist." McEnany, who became a Fox News host after leaving the White House, did not immediately respond. Alyssa Farah Griffin now works for ABC. She also said McEnany was a smart woman and not an idiot. "She knew we lost the election, but she made a calculation that she wanted to have a certain life post-Donald Trump that required staying in his good graces. And that was more important to her.